What I want to talk to you today about is some of the work we've been doing in Gainesville on trying to find molecular tools by which to follow the migration of fall armyworm. And I know we all want to get an early start on the mixers tonight, so I'm not going to give you a lot of background. There are only a couple of things I really want you to keep in mind. One is that there are two genetically distinct populations of fall armyworm. And in the literature, they've been described as strains. They are differentiated behaviorally by their preference to particular plant hosts. So you have a rice strain that one finds preferentially on rice, turf, millet, turf grasses or millet, and a corn strain that, of course, you see on corn, sorghum, and cotton. Now, these strains are morphologically identical, so the only way that you can reliably distinguish them is by molecular markers, such as mitochondrial haplotypes. Now, the other point that I want you to keep in mind is that farmworm does not survive severe winters, yet it infests a large part of the United States and Canada. And this occurs because farmworm undergoes these annual migrations from overwintering sites in Texas and Florida. And the question that, it's a very simple question that we want to address is if we could map this migration pattern. In particular, specifically, we want to be able to find molecular tools by which we could take a migrant population and identify the overwintering source. Okay. And the way we came about doing this, and won't spend too much time on this explanation, is through a sequence analysis of the mitochondrial cytochrome oxidase 1 gene. And there were two sites that were interesting, site 1164 and site 1287. And they were interesting because in the corn strain subpopulation, both of these sites were polymorphic. So about a third of the nucleotides, the 1164, third of the samples of 1164 had an A, the other two-thirds had a G there, and in 1287, a few had an A, and the rest had a G present. Okay. So for the rest of this talk, I'm only going to talk about the corn strain. Now, I use these polymorphisms to kind of create four different haplotype categories, just depending on which nucleotides were present at these sites. So if site 1164 had an A and 1287 had an A, that was haplotype 1, haplotype 2 was AG, 3 is GA, and so forth. Okay. Now, what I next did was simply survey through a large number of samples from Florida, either from traps or from larvae. And what came out of this was a very consistent pattern in terms of haplotype frequencies. And what you see is that the predominant haplotype is haplotype 4, followed by haplotype 2, followed by haplotype 1, a 4 greater than 2, greater than 1 pattern. Haplotype 3 is rarely found and is pretty sporadic. This pattern showed geographical stability in that if we took samples from South Florida or Central Florida and North Florida, we saw the same ratios. There's some fluctuations, but again, it's still the same pattern of 4 greater than 2 greater than 1. And if we look over time, we can see over a 4-year period or between seasons, spring and fall, again, minor fluctuations, but the same general pattern holds, 4 greater than 2 greater than 1. So in Florida, then, these haplotypes, or haplotype classes, if you will, for the corn strain, appear in equilibrium and seem to be homogeneous and stable over time and location. Now, what's interesting is that we also had a number of samples from Brazil. And when we compared the haplotype frequencies in Brazil, well, we did sequence analysis of the cytochrome oxidase 1 gene, we found that, in fact, the same haplotype classes were present, but the proportions were different. Okay, so in Brazil, we saw haplotype 2 being the predominant form, followed by 1, followed by 4. Okay, 2 greater than 1, greater than 4. And we had a number of larval samples from different plant types, and we showed that these ratios, these proportions, were independent of plant hosts. Okay. So we next compared populations from Texas, which is really one of the things we wanted to compare, Texas and Florida. And to our surprise, actually, Texas turned out to be more similar to Brazil than to Florida. And I think you can see that here. Again, larval collections, trap collection, pheromone trap collections from Texas and from three different locations. We see a ratio that is similar to Brazil, haplotype 2 followed by haplotype 1, and more variable amounts of haplotype 4. Let me go back. Sorry. Now, in order to simplify the analysis and help quantify it, you'll know, I think it's pretty obvious that the major differences between these sites happens to be between haplotype 4 and haplotype 2. So all I did was simply take the ratio of 4 to 2, and I'm going to show you the same data, but now with the haplotype 4 to 2 ratio shown on the y-axis, and that's shown here. And I think you can see graphically then the big difference between the Florida pattern and that of the Brazil and Texas pattern. Okay. And so a very high ratio of 4 to 2, which is we think is over 1.5, gives us the standard Florida pattern. Anything below 0.5 is what we call the Brazil or Texas. Now, the important thing here to note is that we have a difference, okay, between populations in Texas and populations in Florida. And even though the haplotypes are shared, it's the frequencies that are different. And if you have this difference, if you have a molecular difference between these two groups, it should at least theoretically be possible to identify migrants from these two groups. The idea being that a migratory population arising from Texas should show the haplotype profile of Texas, and one from Florida, that for Florida. Okay. So as a test of concept, then we surveyed farmworm from a number of different states surrounding Florida and Texas, and that's shown here, again, the 42 ratio, and we found that Georgia had a Florida-like pattern. The other states, Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, Arkansas, Pennsylvania, had a more of a Texas-Brazil pattern, and I interpreted that on a map shown here. So the red dots, obviously, is a Texas pattern. Blue dots, it's a Florida pattern. The arrows are our interpretation of what we're seeing. We think that the Texas overwintering populations down here move to the northeast and probably up north as well, whereas the Florida populations we think are probably going to be limited to the southeastern section of the United States. And maybe that the Appalachian mountain range are acting as a physical block there. So we're heartened by this because I think what we're seeing is a fairly consistent pattern that was suggesting that that these haplotype profiles may actually be looking at the migratory movements. And we noted that, in fact, it was suggested back in 1928 that farmworm from Florida were going to, in fact, move in direction to the southeast, whereas Texas was going to be spreading throughout most of the country. And this was based on examination of wind patterns and trap capture patterns. So the fact is that what we're seeing with our molecular tools are quite similar to what had been suggested previously. Okay. So I think we do have a tool now that we can follow migrations of fall armworm, at least from Florida and Texas. And our working model is that the Florida population is going to be geographically limited to the southeast portion of the country. And Texas is going to be is really at fault for most of the infestation occurring in the United States, in most of the central eastern United States and Canada. And I didn't spend much time on this, but the fact that the proportion differences have been stable over at least a 5-year period suggests that there's actually rather limited mixing of the Texas and Florida populations, which is interesting for those who believe that there is a reverse migration, that farmer from the north moved back to the south. It may be that their geographical limitations or restrictions in where they're migrating may limit the amount that they interact with each other. In the longer term, we want to expand this type of mapping at a more hemispheric level. And so I've noted already that we have samples from Brazil and parts of the United States. We also have some sampling from the Caribbean and Puerto Rico. These show a Florida pattern, suggesting that there may be some interactions and genetic similarities between the Florida and the Caribbean populations. And the open circles indicate where we currently have collaborations or attempting to get cooperators to send us samples for further study of this type. Finally, I just want to acknowledge a number of people, but we have great technical help at Gainesville, and of course there are a lot of people who have been kind enough to send us samples into collecting out in the field. We thank them. Any questions?